Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Always a pleasure to be able to share a positive, empowering segment with you. This is all about health and healing and trying to understand how we get sick, what we can do to prevent it, and what are the alternatives that we can incorporate, all based upon the Library of Medicine, the National Repository for All Good Science, peer-reviewed journals at respected institutions. For example, how many people have to take aspirin every day? Remember, for decades, almost 50 years, we were told to take one full aspirin a day if we had a risk of stroke. And people did that. Now, about 2 years ago, they said, no, that's not good because there's a lot of bleeding, tens of thousands of people dying because of bleeding from the aspirin. Yes, aspirin will thin the blood. That's the object of the exercise. But it also causes death. So take a mini aspirin, baby aspirin. All right, so people did that. Recently, when I was doing my annual checkup and my cardiologist was going over things that he suggested, and I said, what options do you offer for a person who has high blood pressure? He said, well, there's four or five good medications that can keep the blood from lumping together, aggregating, and causing a stroke. You know, you get a clot, and the more fat you have in the diet, the more likely that is to happen. The thicker the blood, if you're dehydrated, remember, water and juice thin the blood, and therefore allow less opportunity for that to happen. Now, if you're taking really good care of yourself, you're having celery seed extract. That's one of the best things to lower blood pressure. But also celery and cucumber and lemon juice each morning. That's really a superstar for protecting your heart and your arteries and the blood from a stroke. According to this new study at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland, tomato extract shows blood thinning potential versus an aspirin. So a tomato extract has been shown to thin blood in healthy people and without the side effects of the aspirin, and that's terrific. The research published in the European Journal of Clinical Nutrition concluded that lycopene, L-Y-C-O-P-E-N-E, that's what you find in your red fruits and vegetables, watermelon, it's in abundance. When you have a glass of watermelon juice, you're really flooding the body with lycopene and lutein, and vitamin C, antioxidants. When you have a glass of tomato juice, the same thing. When you have a bowl of raspberries, cherries, strawberries, the same thing. So we need the rainbow diet. We need fruits and vegetables of all different types of colors into our diet. We're not only benefiting from the fiber, which is a soothing fiber that cleanses the intestine and colon, and prevents polyps, which can then lead to cancer of the colon. But we're also flooding the body with beta-carotene, the carotenoids. And in this case, they found that the lycopene from tomatoes makes a big difference. They were working with the Rouet Institute of Nutrition and Health at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland, and they showed that both tomato extracts could be used as alternatives to drugs like aspirin for blood thinning. Now, I didn't have this study with me. It's just brand new today when I visited my cardiologist. But what was of interest was he said that there was no alternative approaches to, let's say, thinning the blood. And so I took him a little later, left at his office, over 1,000 studies from the peer-reviewed literature showing, yes, there are alternatives that are not only as good, but far better because there's no side effects. Because guess what one of the leading side effects of the blood thinning medication is? Stroke and heart attack. Also, when you have a B-complex, 25 milligram B-complex each day in the diet, you're getting vitamin B12, folic acid, vitamin B6, and then take in some vitamin C. And why is that good? Because that B-complex with vitamin C lowers a major cause of heart attack and stroke. And that is one of the many silent killers. You can't feel it. You don't know if it's elevated. And it's called homocysteine. So when you get a homocysteine up around 15, 16, 17, in that whole range, you're at greater risk. You want it down low. And that brings it down low. So just another simple thing. He was not aware of that. Also, the antioxidants can lower your C-reactive protein. The C-reactive protein is directly proportional to your risk of a heart attack or stroke. The higher it is, the greater the risk. You could have a 100, 200% increase in the risk. You'd never know it. A simple blood test, inexpensive, probably around $150 twice a year. And there are many different groups that will do the blood test and test them to see your lipid profile, your triglycerides. If those are elevated, again, higher risk for heart attack and cancers. And this way, fibrinogen, same. So it's just easy, inexpensive. You get the blood test, and then you can see, ah, I didn't know this was elevated. Then you can lower it and stay out of harm's way. But the whole idea that we only can take aspirin, wrong. It might take a year or two or three or five before they finally get into this, but that's important that they know that this exists. So there are many treatments that can help you thin the blood naturally and keep you safe. And by the way, there's a whole lot that is to be said for the American diet causing hypertension and heart disease to begin with. Now, penicillin is one of the miracles of medicine. It has saved countless lives, and we have Alexander Fleming to thank for that. But here's the point. It's a double-edged sword. When you use penicillin too often and early in life, according to the latest study from McMaster's University in Canada, even in low doses, it affects your gut microbiome. That's your gut bacteria, and that can contribute to brain inflammation and changes in your behavior. Now, since the 1970s, in fact, it was 1974, that I published a book called Body Pollution, and it was very popular. It was a health and nutrition bestseller, and in it, I took a look at how much penicillin or other, and I should say not just penicillin, but how many other of the antibiotics were being used in cattle, in pigs, in chickens. Why? It causes them to gain weight. And if you're raising cattle, you sell the cattle based upon price per pound. So if it's $1 per pound, oh, then you want as many pounds as possible. So pumping them up with a lot of water and then giving them antibiotics, they'll get up at a lot of weight. Trouble is, they're supposed to stop giving them the antibiotics before their slaughter. But it doesn't work that way. Sample after sample showed that there was antibiotics in the meat that was from the animal. Now, what that does is, even in small amounts, that adversely affects your immune system, your gut bacteria, because the antibiotics are non-selective. They'll just kill the bad bacteria, but they kill the good bacteria along with it. Now, if you're eating sugar, that feeds the bad bacteria. Alcohol feeds the bad bacteria. So you have to be aware that the average American diet feeds the bad bacteria and therefore hurts your immune system, whereas the good bacteria will end up causing, let's say if you had something like beet juice, all right, or cabbage juice, that feeds with prebiotics, that feeds the good bacteria. And if you have a healthy, clean diet, that feeds the, miso, tempeh, a lot of tofu, you can get a lot of the really good probiotics. Or you can just take a capsule of probiotics each day. The more healthy probiotics you have in your system, the healthier your immune system, the less inflammation. And that's exactly what this study at McMaster's University found. So it found that if you used penicillin early in life, even in low doses, it was going to affect, in a negative way, your gut bacteria, and that in turn contributed to brain inflammation and changes in behavior. So, look, when antibiotics are necessary, great, they save lives. But we've just used them too often for too many things, including for influenza or the cold. The rhinovirus is one of the most common causes of a cold. Antibiotics don't work on viruses, they work on bacteria. So in 1 year, almost 35% of all the prescriptions for influenza, which is viral, and colds, which are viral, were for antibiotics. Why? Unless you have a bacterial infection in your lungs, there's no reason for that. And then that destroys the good bacteria. Therefore, when you need your immune system, you're sick, you want it there, you don't have it. So just something to think about. And this was a good study done at the St. Joseph Health, Hamilton and McMaster University. So just be aware, there's always a problem when we create imbalances in our gut microbiome. Now, this is a good study from the Royden Clinic, and it says high-dose vitamin C reduces inflammation in cancer patients. We know the value and impact of a daily vitamin C supplement, as well as high-concentrated doses for acute illness, and that is becoming more popular. Now, mind you, it's not because it hasn't been in the scientific literature. There's abundance of information showing that intravenous vitamin C and other forms of vitamin C, of the lysosomal vitamin C, treats infections and also is an anti-cancer therapy. Now, another study is confirming its effectiveness against inflammation in cancer patients, one of the primary markers. High levels of inflammation seem to indicate a higher risk of cancer as well as less hopeful prognosis for healing and recovery. Inflammation impairs the immune system, and it plays a role in cachexia, C-A-C-H-E-X-I-A, which is the wasting away of the body, and lower tolerance of numerous cancer treatments. And generally, if you're deficient in vitamin C, you have a decreased health and quality of life. So this study made use of high-dose intravenous vitamin C, and the results found great promise for the use of high-dose intravenous vitamin C for reducing inflammation in cancer patients. All good news. Having trouble sleeping? A lot of people do. How about trying exercise? Yes. Norwegian University for Science and Technology just put out a publication this week that show that the vast majority of people have trouble sleeping from time to time. However, 10 to 20% of the population struggle more than the rest of us and have serious long-term sleep problems. If you don't get enough sleep, your immune system is not going to be strong. Many people who struggle with insomnia sooner or later resort to some form of sleeping aid. Moreover, one study of more than 34,000 adults would suggest that some of them should exercise instead. A scientific study observed that people who were in better physical condition have a lower risk of taking prescription sleeping pills. So exercising during the day helps you sleep better at night. That's according to the professor at Norwegian University of Science and Technology, Department of Public Health and Nursing. And that's good. They looked at 240,000 people in this survey and over a period of years. The more exercise you did, the better it was to get to sleep and let the body recover at night. Also, a new study puts gut microbiome, what we were just discussing, at the center of Parkinson's disease pathogenesis. This is the University of Alabama in Birmingham. New research from the University of Alabama says the gut microbiome, that's your good bacteria, is involved in multiple pathways and the pathogenesis of Parkinson's disease. The findings are published in the current issue of Nature Communications, and it shows a wide imbalance in the microbiome composition in persons with Parkinson's. And the study is the largest microbiome study conducted at the highest resolution. So It's important. Take the microbiome seriously. Feed it daily. Give your body the probiotics, prebiotics, so you have a healthy gut. Stay away from the sugars. They feed the bad bacteria. Stay away from meat and the processed foods, alcohol. That all destroys your microbiome. In fact, I was working with a person with Parkinson's. His name was Thomas. He was a 70-year-old African-American, and his profession was as an engineer and a draftsman. And when he came into the study, all the people in the brain anti-aging study, about 40 people, they all had had their medical examinations by a pathologist, board-certified pathologist, and they had all their blood workups done, their examinations. They had to have had either Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, dementia, whatever they had to have it for at least 2 years with no success in any of the current treatments they were taking to qualify to get into the study. We met every week for 16 months. It was a long, long study. And we filmed everyone. Why? Simple. Because earlier in my career, I was in a national debate. I was debating all the time. People from the sugar industry and the meat industry and the toiletry industries, cosmetic industries. I was the point person to go out there because I was the one who did the research and was not afraid of the debates. And in one of these debates, someone, when we were talking about the American diet and how much sugar it had and what that did to our bodies, someone says, well, you know, where's your proof? You know, show me a before and after. How do you know that a person had cancer to begin with, especially stage 4 cancer, and now you're claiming that the person is well based upon your protocols? Okay. Well, that was a thought I had not had. So from then on, I had absolute irrefutable proof. I'd have them bring their medical records. So I had before, and then I had the medical records during and at the end. And then I videotaped everyone. So everyone who comes into any study, thousands and thousands of people, my name is Bob. I'm 45 years old. I'm suffering with Parkinson's. I've had Parkinson's for 8 years. I've been using these medications. The hope is that they will slow down the progression. Sometimes I'll have a relapse. Sometimes I'm in remission. But it's always going down. Right? And then let's say a year or 2 years later, hi, I'm Bob. My neurologists right now say that they don't know why, but I'm no longer suffering from Parkinson's. My hands are steady. I don't have any Parkinsonian conditions. I sleep well. I have strength in my muscles. I have balance. I have coordination. I don't fall over. And here's my current medical records. And then they read their latest diagnosis from their original doctor. So we went to those extremes. So here it is. Here's Thomas. And we use a split screen. On the very first day, if you're watching this now, and by the way, I'm Zoom streaming, video streaming this for the health nutrition segment. His hands were shaking like this. He said he couldn't brush his teeth. He couldn't comb his hair. He couldn't put food in his mouth. His wife had to do that for him. And he certainly couldn't continue his career because he couldn't draft anything. And 16 months later, his hands were steady as a rock. He had no imbalances at all. But what was remarkable is he said, but I did have a side effect, a very, very unusual side effect. Caught us all by surprise. What is it? He said, I now have acute memory. Okay, I've never heard the word acute memory. What does that mean? He said, well, just ask me any question about my background. I said, what year did you graduate from high school? He named it. How many people were in your class? 22. Do you remember any of their first names? He gave us the first and last name of every single student. He said, I remember everything. So in that protocol, something, we don't know what, because it was a very interdisciplinary, lots of different things in that protocol, caused his memory to come back. We reconnected the dendrites in his brain. And as a result, he had access to all that memory. So that's what's important. But if you only hear one side of the picture, if you only look at one type of protocol, the orthodox protocol, you won't know that anything else exists. Just saying. All right? So now we're saying that you can have a tremendous difference in the outcome of your Parkinson's disease if you get good quality bacteria into your system on a regular basis, which is not difficult to do. And that's our health and healing for today. But keep this in mind. A lot of Americans are waking up and saying, wow, I should have paid more attention to my choices. And now that I'm at some destination, 50, 40, 60, 70, and I don't feel the same, I don't look the same, is there anything that can be done? Yes. A lot you can do to reverse the damage and to ensure that the next stage of your life is a healthier one. Go to GaryNall.com. Scroll down to where it says newsletter. Sign up for the newsletter. It's free. And it'll go directly to your computer every morning. So when you wake up, you have a plethora of information, different every single day, all from peer-reviewed literature, all meant to empower you to live a longer and healthier life. We're going to take a short break and come right back. Please stay with us. And now we're going to address one and possibly more individuals in our audience who've had questions about statements concerning the masks. As you know, we were a highly masked society. Some people wore two masks. Some people were shown to wear wearing masks while in the water, swimming in the ocean. Wow. Others while they were driving in their cars. Yet there were a lot of contradictions. How is it that you could be masked going into a restaurant, waiting to be seated, sitting down, then removing your mask, eating with all the people in the restaurant, let's say 100 people, including staff, modest-sized restaurant, and then you must put your mask back on. Did the virus decide to take a break? You know, we're not going to infect you over the next hour. Go ahead, take your mask off. It didn't make any sense. But then we started to look for the actual science. Richard Gale, who's a scholar, myself, we scanned all the medical and scientific literature, especially in areas of toxicology, because there are workplace environments for 100 years where you had to wear a mask because the particulate matter in the air was so toxic that if you didn't, you could end up with different diseases, lung diseases, etc. And we examined all the data. We also asked a basic question. This is one of simple science. If, let's just say for our argument's sake, that a virus is 0.1 microns, but the mask, even the best mask, only filters to 2 microns or 3 microns, then an awful lot of virus is going to be able to get into your body via the mask, through the nasal cavity, through the mouth, and through the eyes, the mucous membranes. So then how effective is it? Were there studies to show that if you wore a mask and you had one group wear a mask and be exposed, and another group that did not wear a mask and were exposed, what was the percentage of infectivity? And so we decided to see what does the actual peer review literature show. And by the way, Anthony Fauci, in a 7-hour deposition, when asked about, can you show us a single study in the scientific peer review literature supporting your use of masks, he couldn't. He could not cite a single study. That's interesting. So now we have gotten some evidence, but what preceded this was on two separate occasions, we found some simple observations of interest. One was Del Bigtree, who's done a lot of good work on trying to bring real science to the public and challenge existing pseudoscience. And he had his son in his studio, and he had a little meter inside of all the different variety of masks, from cloth masks and bandana masks to N95 masks. And what he was finding is that within about 15 to 16 seconds of wearing the mask, the meter caused an alarm to go off, showing that there was a lack of oxygen. Now, then a school teacher out west did the same thing. These are not clinical studies. These are merely observations. And he found that in putting every kind of mask on his students, that there was another little alarm that went off after about 15, 16 seconds of wearing it that showed a buildup of carbon dioxide. So then the question is, at what percentage of oxygen could you start to feel unusual, lightheaded, where you needed more oxygen in your system, and yet your mask may have been preventing that? And also, what science exists, good quality peer-reviewed science, that shows that how much carbon dioxide can you breathe back in before there's some deleterious effects? And do we have any good studies showing the long-term effects of over-consuming carbon dioxide? And with that, of course, if you have a cold or flu or COVID, you're breathing right back in and rebounding infection from not expelling that from the body. Legitimate questions. And one of the listeners to the program said that according to his friend who knew all about this, there was no problem at all with mm-hmm. oxygen. In fact, he said in an email to me, you could go down to 5% oxygen without a problem. Well, I'd like to see the science behind that. And also carbon dioxide was not a problem either. So let's go to the actual peer-reviewed science. And to do this, Richard Gell's here, and he's done the homework. Richard, tell us what you found, please.
Yes. Okay. I'm hoping having a little bit of computer problems here, Gary. So anyway, but you're absolutely correct. We're dealing really with very simple mechanics. There's nothing particularly esoteric about testing mask effectiveness and its benefits and risks. We're dealing very much with just simple mechanical measurements, gaseous analysis. So, and mask experimentation on their effectiveness, this is research that's been gone on for several decades now, and the majority of the literature shows that masks are largely useless. Last year, there was a large analysis that found 47 studies confirming that masks were are ineffective, and then there were an additional 32, I'm referring to more recent studies. We could go way back, and then an additional 32 that confirmed their negative health effects. And basically, the masks provide no protection from aerosol penetration, which is really what it's the aerosols that are the vehicle that introduce viruses into our nose and mouth. So it's very much like putting squishing your face up against a chain link fence and then believing it will stop sand thrown into your face. It's just a comfort blanket in the shape of a face diaper. Moreover, exhaled viruses will not be able to escape in some context sufficient, and they'll linger on that on the mask, and they'll concentrate into the nasal passages, they'll enter the olfactory nerves, and there's research that even shows that extended mask use can actually bring the viral infections traveling into the brain. And then there's the direct rebreathing of the virus back into the nasal passages and this migration of the virus, just concentrating the virus throughout the body. There was a study that found that 81% of workers wearing masks over many hours had frequent headaches. It was a very high percent, and this is due to hypoxia, as you mentioned. So there's the reduction of the blood oxygen, that's hypoxia. There was a large German randomized control study that found that, particularly for children, that CO2, carbon dioxide, was increased by 600%. And that was a study that was published in JAMA, in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And now if we look at this based upon the German regulatory requirements, because the study was done in Germany, normal CO2 levels in the air is supposed to be about 400 particles per million, okay? Governments allow for permit. They can vary between different nations, CO2 level concentrations. And the study actually found on average that there was 14,000 parts per million. One child had 25,000 particles per million. And it only takes about 3 minutes of mask wearing for children to reach the 14,000 average level. So it just shows how quickly that these concentrations can build up into the bloodstream. The University of Brussels they found that a drop in the oxygen levels, bringing about this condition of hypoxia, is associated with impaired immunity. It inhibits your CD4. T lymphocytes that are necessary to fight viral, in fact, to fight viral infections. CD4, the manufacturing of TD4 cells requires higher oxygen levels in order to do. And then you also mentioned there's the elevation of carbon dioxide, the CO2 in the blood, which is hypercapnia. And there's plenty of studies showing that masks contribute to hypercapnia as well. There was a Northwestern and University of Southern Denmark study that found that masks cause one to rebreathe the carbon dioxide that the lungs are attempting to expel. So it's working counter to what the body actually wants to be doing. And then this in turn also reduces the immune response negatively, particularly with the epithelial cells in the lungs and in the blood vessels. It lowers the amount of oxygen exchange across the alveolar membranes. We've all heard of the N95 masks, which are shown to reduce, just on average, oxygen by approximately 20%. And what occurs here is that there's a great deal of moisture retention, and it's particularly when you're reusing your a cloth mask, and then poor filtration, and this increases the risk of the infection itself. Moreover, the viruses can survive for a period of time just on the surface of the face mask. So if you're in a closed space and all, and people are breathing, the respiration of particular viruses, a lot of this can just be clinging onto the face mask as well. There was a study just last in February this year by a Belgian company called CNSMO. They perform a lot of safety studies of various projects for manufacturers and companies making different products, but particularly with trace elements and nanomaterials. And they found that the synthetic fibers in the face mask containing, which most contain this nanotitanium dioxide, that they not only don't stop viruses, but they are exposing the wearer to four times the acceptable levels of the carcinogenic exposure to the titanium dioxide, as well as formaldehyde, which is also found used in face masks. And this is also the study was confirmed also by New York University, that found that a long-term wearing of these face masks contribute to advanced stage lung cancer. So, And just to take this a little further, because we're also already seeing that toddlers wearing masks have increased rates of underdeveloped speech and social skills by over 30%. Particularly with infants, and people are putting these masks on infants. Infants begin by learning speech by observing the lip movement. This is very well known in developmental psychology, child psychology, that the infants are very attentive to lip movement and the sounds that come out. So if you're wearing masks, this is interfering in children's speech. A Brown University study found that there's been a reduced verbal motor, just overall cognitive performance, lower IQ of young children during the pandemic compared to children that were raised in the pre-pandemic era. Oxford University found that 8 out of 10 children have worsening of psychological behavior and increased negative feelings about themselves during the pandemic because of all the face wearing, mask wearing. And then there are other, and of course, there are many other kind of adverse effects. One study from New York City dentists, they reported the steep rise in tooth decay and receding gums from long-term mask use. That's a recent study. There's the problem, particularly with children and adolescents, they're going through puberty and all the enormous rise of acne vulgaris, you know, because of all the moisture and the germs together causing facial skin lesions, dermatitis, and that, which can then worsen into acne. And then finally, there's just also the increase in stress hormones due to the mind-body kind of relationship that we're constantly in. When you're wearing a mask, it's almost as if you're in a constant state of fear of some kind of an invisible enemy. And that this, as we all, you stated with the health news that you share so often, there's numerous studies showing the stress suppresses the immune system, and very often by raising anxiety, that we know has an adverse impact on immune systems. And this is very well documented in the book that was called Cytokine Stress and Immunity. It was published back in 2007. So, that's what I'd like to share here. I think that in retrospect to this, in light of all this research, and there's certainly much, much more, it really raises a fundamental question, is what's the motivation behind this push to wear a mask? Because the science and all, by many different medical disciplines, as you notice from just the psychology and dentistry and chemistry and medicine, all showing the overwhelming benefit risk ratio, leaning overwhelmingly to the risks of wearing face masks as opposed to their benefits. So that's what I like to share.
Well, that gives us a much more objective and honest overview. And if you could send to Rodney the citations, so anyone who doubts that what we are sharing is based upon real peer-reviewed science and not what Fauci and the rest said was, well, we have the proof. And then when they were asked under oath in a deposition in a court proceeding last week, he said he didn't have a single study he could cite. And yet look at all the studies that already pre-existed that anybody could find on the toxic air in different factories and the OSHA standards. And also remember, I think it was about a year ago, we did a report showing how many studies showed that the fibers can come off in a mask, and some of those are synthetic fibers that a person would breathe and lodge in their lungs. That would lead to fibrosis or other conditions that could be deadly or debilitating, and there's no current medical technology that can remove those fibers. And yet, that is not mentioned at all. And think how many people wash their mask or don't wash their mask. When you wash the mask, every time you wash the mask, you make it more vulnerable to shedding, and that shedding makes it very vulnerable for its materials to come into the air passageways. Also, a surgeon friend of mine said, look, we wear masks for one reason only. We do not care about getting infected by a virus. We care about, in surgery, not having blood or body fluids end up in our eyes, nose, or mouth. That's why we wear it. And he said, it's not about being antiviral. And then we also know that some of these masks should only be worn once. That's it, one time. And yet we have children wearing them every day, all day. And then what will be the long-term neurological consequences to that, we have no idea of knowing, except one of the leading worldwide neurologists, a woman from Great Britain, said that she wrote a paper on this about a year ago saying that we're going to end up with an epidemic of neurological conditions in children because of this heavy use. Thank you very much, Richard. We appreciate you coming on and sharing your insights with us.
Okay. So you got everything?
We have to go because we have to take a break, and our next segment is coming right up. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Now, before we get to our longer clips, we have a really interesting group of things to discuss. Let's hear from Tulsi Gabbard. It's a short clip. It's only a minute and 47 seconds, but she sings something that is, I believe, we need in the national dialogue. You can agree or disagree with her, but remember, she was selected by the Democratic National Group to be right in their midst as a junior freshman in Congress. She had all the right checkoffs, female, indigenous culture, Army vet, and highly ethical, well-educated. And she believed in historical liberal principles, anti-war and helping the poor and the working class, challenging the oligarchy. She was even invited to come and speak at that Democratic National Convention that year. And she was groomed on the fast track. And then she started to put together some legislation that actually would honor the people. And Nancy Pelosi would not allow it out of committee, wouldn't allow it to be voted upon. And this went on and on and on. No matter what she did, it was all blocked. Then she started realizing, you know, the pit of vipers that she had entered with some idealism. And then she ran for president, and then she quit the Democratic Party to become an independent. And here are some of her thoughts.
But we look to the past. Feminists of previous generations, they were primarily focused on securing rights, whether it was the right to vote, the right to work and be paid fairly, or the right to have access to the same opportunities in sports and education. Fast forward to today. Today's self-proclaimed feminists will not define what a woman is and are unfortunately actively seeking to erase the progress that Title IX has made over the last 50 years by essentially trying to erase women as an entire category of people. Now, there's a lot of different ways this is happening, but one of those ways is by changing language, which is a really big deal. Doing things like, instead of using the term mother, we're told we have to use the term birthing person. And instead of referring to someone as a woman, refer to them as a menstruating person. Now, if you walk onto a lot of college campuses these days, you can see just how toxic this modern brand of feminism has become. There's no interest in tolerance or respect or people having different views or opinions and perspectives. No welcome to an open marketplace of ideas. Anybody who has a different view or expresses dissent or challenge or questions this narrative that they're pushing is shouted down, is attempted to be silenced, and essentially is forced into self-censorship or compliance through intimidation and bullying. Now, it's important for all of us that we not stand by and allow this to happen, that we take action, that we lift our voices to resist this insanity and take a stand for objective truth and take a stand for the protection of women and girls, not only today, but for generations to come.
On an upcoming program, I'll invite Tulsi on so that you can ask questions or make statements directly to her. And now we have a clip from Dr. Jean Twinge, a psychologist, talking about Generation Z refuses to grow up. Let's see if we agree or disagree in part or whole, but something that should be discussed. Now to the clip.
You introduce the book, Who is iGen and How Do We Know? And then talk about chapter one, In No Hurry, Growing Up Slowly. That's the prolongation of childhood. And so tell us about that and also about what you make of it.
Yeah, so childhood really does last longer now. Kids are not as independent. And when they get to be teenagers, they're just less likely to do all of these things that adults do and children don't do. And it's part of a bigger cultural story. It's part of what evolutionary psychologists call a slow life strategy. So that means at times and places when people live longer, when healthcare is better, and when education takes longer to finish, parents tend to make the choice to have fewer children and nurture them more carefully. So that's a pretty good description of the way that we raise kids now. So you get that kids don't walk to school by themselves as much. And then when they're teens, they are more reluctant to get their driver's license or to go out or to date or have a paid job. And then by young adulthood, it takes longer for people to settle into a career and get married and have children. And then even older adults affects them too, that 50 is the new 40 and people are healthy for longer. So the entire trajectory of life has really slowed down. And for iGen or Generation Z, where that really comes out is that their teen years are very different from their Gen X parents who remember, you know, going out, driving around in cars, getting in trouble, drinking alcohol, all of those things, and their kids don't do that as much.
So do you see this as a prolongation of childhood in a positive way because people have longer to live? Or because the cynic in me, I suppose the Freudian too, thinks of this as a consequence of overprotective parenting and the inappropriate extension of childhood into adolescence? And I'm wondering too, to what degree you talked about improvements in healthcare and transformations in technology, longer lifespan. To what degree is this also a consequence of the fact that people are older when they have children, that they have fewer children, and that they're wealthier, which all of that would make them in some sense more conservative, but also in some strange sense more careful with their children and maybe even more inappropriately careful. And especially the age of parents that's increased over the years, and the fact that there are fewer siblings, which also seems to me to tie into your work on narcissism, because I think siblings tend to knock the narcissism out of each other. And so when you don't have any, well, you definitely are a special, especially if your parents have been waiting for you for a long time.
Yeah, so it's definitely a function of people waiting longer to have kids. And as you said, they have more resources and they have fewer children. Because when you think about this strategy, that's when it happens. It happens when there's more security and when everything tends to slow down. And when there's fewer kids, just from an evolutionary perspective, then parents are going to protect them more. It's also, you just can't keep track of them all when there's a lot of them. So my mother comes from a family like that. There were 8 children in her family and a dairy farm in Minnesota. And they couldn't possibly, you know, have run their dairy farm and kept track of every single one of the kids. So they learned how to be independent very early on. But, you know, that was in the 1940s and 50s. And that was the standard at the time, even families with fewer kids, it was normal for the children to go and play, and it was be home at dinner or come home when the streetlights come on if you grew up in a more urban setting. But that was the idea of, you know, you kind of let kids do what they wanted to, and that's different now. And it's not just from the parents. So I think sometimes if you just look at other, the parents are overprotective, you miss some of the bigger cultural story that, I mean, this has been codified into law in a lot of places. In the state of Illinois, you're not allowed to leave a child alone until they're 14 years old, which to a Gen Xer is ridiculous.
Right. So do you see this, how do you evaluate this as a psychologist? Do you just see this as a part of the normal variation in parenting behavior as a consequence of technological transformation, or do you see something that's permanently affecting people's capability of maturing?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's some of both. It is part of technology, certainly, that all of these causes are rooted in technology, better healthcare, education taking longer for a more complex society and more knowledge that pushes toward that slow life strategy. So it's an adaptation. It's an adaptation to a particular place and time. So there's trade-offs. Neither a slow life strategy or a fast life strategy is all good or all bad. There are some clear advantages. The kids are not growing up as fast. Most parents are thrilled that not as many teens are having sex or drinking alcohol. But there is the downside. The downside is that we have a generation growing to adulthood who doesn't have as much experience with independence. And it's difficult often for them to make decisions on their own. So when I travel around to universities, this is what I hear very consistently. I have more and more students who can't make even simple decisions without texting their parents. And to take the perspective of this young generation too, which I think is important, it makes sense. It's, you know, this is not necessarily how they asked to be raised. This is the culture that they grew up in. And they arrive at university without those experiences of making those decisions. And it's really, really hard for them to do that and to make that adjustment. So that's the big downside. So that's where I think, you know, as you said, you can be more of a cynic or a critic and say, you know, this is definitely not all good. I do hesitate to use the word maturity, though, because is it more mature or less mature to drink alcohol when you're 17? It's really neither one. So I think it's better to focus on that it's slower development, not necessarily better, not necessarily worse, but slower.
Yeah, well, there were studies of alcohol use I remember conducted when I was studying alcohol several decades ago, looking at, let's say, life outcomes among teenagers as a consequence of their proclivity to break rules. And the findings basically were that, and this is probably what you'd expect, is that the kids who broke no rules were much more likely to be dependent, depressed, and anxious. And the kids that broke too many rules were much more likely to be antisocial, right, and criminal. Mm-hmm. And so there's a sweet spot in the middle, like there is so often, mm-hmm. where a certain right. amount of experimentation is exactly what you'd hope for. And the question would be, if the proclivity of young people to drink less alcohol, and I mean alcohol is pretty damn toxic, it's a bad drug, all things considered, is a net good because they're delaying their experimentation. That's probably neurologically healthy, at least with regards to the effects of alcohol. But if it means that they're doing less experimentation in general, then that the question is what the long-term consequences are. I mean, if it's only a delayed maturation, then in some sense, it doesn't make that much difference. But if it's a permanent abdication of maturation, then that's a completely different issue. And you also mentioned cell phones and texting parents. I mean, one of the ways that people learned to make decisions before there were cell phones is that they didn't really have a choice. Because if you were away from your parents in a car, you were actually away, unless you could get to a payphone, let's say. But even then, that wasn't necessarily all that likely, and you'd have to go search one out. And so you were on your own. It wasn't just like you were acting like it. And now, because you're connected all the time with this electronic tether, especially, I would say, if your parents are somewhat anxious, then, well, under what circumstances should you make your own decisions? And that was never a choice before, and those sorts of things become problematic when they become a choice.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, that's the other piece that technology plays. And it is, yeah, you know, even when you're at university, you can constantly contact your parents in a way that didn't used to be possible. And the other part of it too, and this gets to some of the other trends in the book, is that socializing for teens has moved online. And so you think about a lot of those things on that list that adults do and children don't, where a lot of them involve getting out of the house and hanging out with friends and getting in a car, usually to go be with other people. And that doesn't happen as much now because the party is on Snapchat or on Instagram. So that's the other way that technology is playing a role, is there's so much more interaction online and less face-to-face.
We're out of time, everyone. I want to thank you for listening in. And as you see, we're broadening our topics of what we feel we should know more about, like artificial intelligence, because it's here and it's not going away. And like it or not, it's going to adversely affect all of us. Because with that artificial intelligence, they're now wanting to have smart homes, smart cities, where every movement you have, every word you say, every thought you'll have, they'll know it. And they'll be able to control a lot of that unless we say no, unless we go off their grid. Can we do it? Will we do it? I don't know. Your guess is as good as mine at this moment. Have we done anything in the past to show that we're going to resist this kind of behavior? Well, we didn't stand up as a nation and fight McCarthy. It took McCarthy going after the army to make his big mistake. That was his Waterloo. But other than that, he would have just continued to gain power and destroy lives. So up to this point, we've seen no mass outpouring of the population of the journalists of America supporting and condemning the attacks against Julian Assange by our government and the British government, etc. So if we're not able to mass on important issues, what is the likelihood that we'll say no to artificial intelligence, transhumanism, and automation? Still remains to be seen. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.